Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you a special feature focusing on the Abbey of Monte Cassino, which includes an exclusive interview with the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notker Wolf, and a collage of writings surrounding this abbey, both before and after its bombing. Well, thanks so much for joining us once again. During his weekly general audience this week, Benedict XVI launched an appeal to everyone who uses new communications technology, especially young people, with a bid to utilize these new means in a positive way, bearing in mind their great potential in terms of building up bonds of friendship and solidarity that can contribute to a better world. On Sunday, however, while the Church celebrates World Communications Day, the Pope travels south of Rome to the very place where St. Benedict wrote his rule, Monte Cassino, or Mount Cassino, where a great abbey stands, one often referred to as the cradle of Western monasticism. It was once visited by Charlemagne, destroyed by the Saracens, hit by an earthquake in 1349, sacked by Napoleon's troops, and more recently bombed by the Allied forces during World War II. Among the many Benedictines joining the Pope there on Sunday is the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notker Wolf. He was kind enough to find the time to sit down with me at his Rome headquarters of St. Anselmo earlier in the week. I began by asking him what his full title was. As you'll discover in a moment, he had quite a lot to say.
I'm the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, or the Benedictine Order, usually we say, but we are not a real order, a centralized order, but we are a confederation of 20 congregations. They are also groups of different monasteries, very often now internationally, linked together. It's practically a big network. And I'm the coordinator, I'm the representative, and I should try to create unity among the monasteries and cooperation. That's my biggest job, but here at Sant'Anselmo, I'm also the abbot of our monastery here, but they are not monks of Sant'Anselmo, they are monks of different monasteries coming here for studies or for teaching as professors. So I'm also the head of our university here, so it's rather a busy job, I would say.
When Pope Benedict XVI visits the Abbey of Monte Cassino, he visits a place where St. Benedict once lived and worked, where he wrote his rule. What, in your opinion, does this abbey signify to him personally as the Pope who picked Benedict as patron of his pontificate?
One thing is that he wrote a book, that's to say, on the basis of an interview with some German journalists in this place. Also, for a longer time, he stayed there.
Before he became Pope?
Before, of course, when he was still a cardinal. The book is called The Salt of the Earth. It's on different issues. But now, when he became Pope, he chose the name of Benedict for two reasons. One was Benedict XV, who wanted to create peace after World War I or towards the end of World War I, but now also to give a signal for Europe, to remind Europe that Europe has been built up by the message of Jesus Christ and transmitted by the monks. And what is so important for the monks, that God is the center of our life. God has sacrificed his son for our sake, for the sake of the human being, for the healing, for the salvation. But nevertheless, God is the center of our life. And we are not so important, I would say. But nevertheless, we are important to God. But to put God again as the highest norm of our life, in our everyday life, in politics, in society, in everything.
Going a little bit deeper as regards Benedict XVI, he was elected to the papacy 4 years ago. Would you describe these years as having benefited from a Benedictine leadership? Can you say that it is a Benedictine leadership in a way?
It's very hard to say. I don't know, because he has his leadership, his kind of doing it as he was used to already as the head of the Congregation for
Doctrine and Faith.
So he, in some way he is a manager, but he has become now the pastor of the whole world. And you can see it in his encyclicals, you can see it in his teachings, but he's more the catechist, I would say, on Wednesdays in the general audiences, or also on Sundays after the Angelus. But there he touches more the everyday questions also. So he is, I would say, it's not so much Benedictine, he doesn't live in a community. The abbot is especially made and elected for his community to favor the individuals on their spiritual way to God, to help them and to lead a community. Very often I take the example of Moses going with his people through the desert. Perhaps in that way also the Pope is somehow a kind of Moses going through the desert with his people, but he knows quite well his way. Whereas an abbot sometimes says, I don't know exactly the way, but I trust in the Lord that he may guide us.
But there's definitely an affinity anyway, isn't there, with the Benedictine rule, as it were.
Yeah.
And St. Benedict.
He appreciates the Benedictine rule, also liturgy very much. I would say the elegant style, but not the pompous way of doing it. The Pope is coming from Bavaria, from a Baroque.
You yourself are from Bavaria.
I'm too from Bavaria. So I know our Baroque mentality with all the beautiful masses of Haydn, Mozart. And all the beautiful Baroque vestments, but especially also the lovely churches. It's a far lighter Baroque than the Roman Baroque, for example.
Can we get back to Monte Cassino? What do you think this visit means to Benedictines across the world?
There will be a number of Benedictine abbots, so it's honoring the center, the origin of our Benedictine way of life, and of Saint Benedict himself. He never wanted to be the great man, but he became it because he gave us a rule based on the gospel. If you read the rule of Saint Benedict, it's full of quotations of the Bible, but he is not doing it in a way that he says, this is the phrase and you make deductions of that. Now you have to live according to that. But he has absorbed by the Lectio Divina, or by the spiritual reading, by the masticating, I would say, chewing the Bible. It has become part of his own being. And so when he writes, it comes out, and that's what the Holy Father also wants, that we get again absorbed. We absorb the Bible, but we are absorbed by the Word of God.
Earlier on, you mentioned Europe. In your opinion, what did Pope Paul VI wish to achieve back in October 1964 when he proclaimed St. Benedict patron of Europe? What I mean is, how can someone who wrote in the 500s, I suppose, be recognized as having such a fundamental influence on the development of European civilization and culture. I do know about the importance of drawing on Christian roots, and I know that Benedict was an exceptionally enlightened man. But isn't this pushing things a bit?
I was personally present at that proclamation.
L'ideale dell'unità spirituale dell'Europa, e non manchi loro l'aiuto dall'alto per realizzarlo in pratici e prove di ordinamenti che abbiamo voluto proclamare San Benedetto patrono e patrone dell'Europa.
On the 24th of October in 64, and we were very much convinced that it's true like this, not because St. Benedict would have liked to do extraordinary things, but it's through the gospel that he had worked, and through his rule then, that he has given a basis to European culture. To give an example, when he says that during Lent each monk should read a book, or that they should use books and read during Mass and during the meals at table, that means that you have to train your people that they can read. We had no schools at those times. So Benedictines set up schools, of course, first for their own monks, but then people came from outside. I had the same example now in Africa. In one of our monasteries, the monks set up their own school, and then the other religious orders sent their candidates also there for schoolings. And now the people living around said, but also our boys and girls would like to learn something. So by this way, by a natural way, and of course you couldn't go to buy some penguin books or something, some pocket books somewhere. You had to prepare the books. You had to write books. That means you had to learn how to write. You had to prepare the skin on which you wrote the books. You had to copy lots of the old texts of it, because they wanted to learn good Latin and Greek. So they copied all the codices of the ancient period, of the Roman period. That was, I would say, a very natural way. They had to live also upon the work of their own hands. They created agriculture. And they developed handcrafts and all these things. And this brought, practically, the culture of Europe. But not because they sat down and had some programs. But it was a natural way. I would say the gospel, if you take it serious, shapes not only the individual, but the whole culture. Also the way of living together. And then, of course, when you want to have a beautiful ceremony or beautiful liturgy, you need also a beautiful church for that. And therefore, the Benedictines constructed later on the Cistercians and so on, these beautiful churches we have all around. So, you see, as I say, it's not that you sit down on the computer and develop a lovely program, this is the gospel and or the holy rule of St. Benedict. No, it's by living you are creating culture.
What do you remember about Pope Paul VI on that occasion?
Yes, I was one of the chanters there on this occasion. That was beautiful. It was edifying experience and edifying liturgy, and we were also happy that Saint Benedict was recognized in his values, and we were very happy about Paul VI. And then I got to know how close Paul VI was to the Benedictines. He, as a kid, listened to the beautiful liturgies, to the beautiful music, that impressed him and formed him. So he himself was formed by Saint Benedict also. And as I said, it's not by big teachings, but by this contact with living. And I would like to mention also characteristics of Benedictines. They open their doors for guests. This is one of the major chapters of the rule of Saint Benedict. Each guest should be received like Jesus Christ himself. That creates an openness where all kind of people feel well and happy. Also non-Christians, non-Catholics, also Buddhist monks, they feel at home. You have created a home. I have had in my own monasteries also Chinese bishops from mainland China. They said, here we feel at home. You are received in a family. The big family, which is in our mind, I would say, the natural situation of the human being, that we are the real human being, is not the individual, but being part of a big family.
Of course, the Abbey in Monte Cassino is a small family. That you, I think you have 25 monks there now. Tell me a little about the Abbey itself. It was invaded by the Saracens, sacked by Napoleon's troops, and then more recently razed to the ground. Yet despite the first fierce fury directed at it, it still bears a hopeful motto in Latin, no? Succisa virescit, which means...
Whenever it's cut down, it will flourish again like a tree which is cut down and there are coming out new branches, new sprouts. To me, it's the utmost sign of absurdity to bomb down a monastery. And to bomb down a house of peace, we have written above the entrance of many monasteries, there is written Pax, that means peace. And to bomb down a house of peace, this shows really sin. That sin is against the human being, against peace, against justice. But there was the great miracle that the community had gathered in the small room where St. Benedict had lived. And in spite of the whole bombing, in the end they moved out with a cross, the abbot with a cross in his hands.
The first bombing, because it was bombed further afterwards. You mentioned this legacy of the Second World War. Would you say it's particularly powerful at the Abbey of Monte Cassino? I mean, you're a German, so, you know, you must have heard about or probably had relatives who fought at Monte Cassino, like myself, on the other side.
Yeah.
Do you think it's something you share with your fellow German, Pope Benedict, despite him belonging to a different generation, someone who lived through the Second World War, even though he was a teenager?
Of course, he will be reminded of the whole situation of World War II, of this bombing. And when I'm going to Monte Cassino, I'm also going to Kaira. It's the big German cemetery. I think 20,000 soldiers are buried there. And when you walk around and you see there are the names and the age, and when I see 18 years, 19 years, or 23, it's not just the body which has been bombed down, but lots of hope. The whole future of a young man. It's so crazy. And how much had been bombed down. It's really, it touches my heart always. It touches my heart always. And I say, when finally do we learn that we should live in peace? Like blowing in the wind. The beautiful song. When do people finally learn to live together in peace?
So there's a certain sadness at Monte Cassino, despite the life, the monastic life, the sheltered and beautiful monastic life there, in line with St. Benedict's rule, in this place where, despite the reconstruction, that backdrop of war wounds and indeed war graves still survives.
And many politicians are meeting there from time to time in order to reflect about peace. So Monte Cassino has become a beacon of peace, I would say. And this is, I think, the real legacy of Saint Benedict.
Amen.
Warm thanks there to the Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notko Wolf, for sharing with us his thoughts on all things Benedictine. Meanwhile, stay tuned as we move on in the broadcast, continuing to focus on Monte Cassino, this time on a totally different note in this special feature I've prepared for you, in which I present extracts from the writings of two different men, D.H. Lawrence, who wrote about Monte Cassino in the 1920s, and Rulli Trevelyan, who took part in the fighting in 1944 and subsequently wrote a book about it. The Benedictine Abbey of Monte Cassino was four times razed to the ground and as many times rebuilt. Last time it was pulverized was during the Second World War, in battle and bombings by the Allied forces. It was 1944. Before that, it was a wonderful place. That's according to the personal witness of English writer D.H. Lawrence, who leaves us a record of his visit there in the stone-cold February of 1920. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you a spattering of excerpts of this description, a classic in its kind. A description of Monte Cassino prior to the tragic wartime destruction. When for the Germans, Cassino became the impregnable center of the Gustav Line. And for the Allies fighting their way up the peninsula, the obstacle on the road to Rome. Listen on then, as oblivious of what was to come, Lawrence recounts his climb towards the vast monastery rearing above him from its buttresses. Sean Patrick Lovett reads these excerpts for us.
We twisted up and up the wild hillside, past the old town, past the old castle, past the last villa, between tree and rocks. We saw no one. The whole hill belongs to the monastery, a huge, square-like, fortress place of the 16th century, crowning the near distance. We went up the slope under the big, tunnel-like entrance, and were in the grassy courtyard, with the arched walk on the far sides, and one or two trees. It was like a grassy cloister, but still busy. Black monks were standing chatting, an old peasant was just driving two sheep from the cloister, and an old monk was darting into the little post office.
And upon entering the monastery, up the narrow stairs and into the long, old, naked white corridors, Lawrence then describes the stunning view from the balcony of one of the bedrooms, beyond the clustered buildings of the farm below, and the oak woods and arable fields of the hill summit, and even further beyond.
Beyond the gulf where the world's valley was, and all the mountains that stand in Italy on the plains, as if God had just put them down ready-made. Isn't it wonderful? The most wonderful place on earth.
The most wonderful place on earth, then, this vast monastery, where Lawrence describes, among other things, a Benvenuto Cellini casket of lapis lazuli blue as cornflowers, a courtyard designed by Bramante, all stone and colonnades of arches going round and round, full of sunshine, a little bit ornate but still jolly, sunny and pale stone waiting for lively people, and a crypt, where modern mosaics glowed in wonderful colours, and fascinating fantastic trees and birds, rather like a scene in the theatre. But for Lawrence too, Monte Cassino was most of all a sacred place.
a sacred place, where in the ancient cell, away under the monastery, all the sanctity started. A hilltop which must have been one of man's intense sacred places for 3,000 years.
Never, not even in his wildest dreams, could Lawrence have imagined how, two decades on, this most wonderful place on earth would be blown to smithereens by the Allied forces. In a series of bombings which began on the 15th of March, 1944, as British author Raleigh Trevelyan describes in his book Rome 44, The Battle for the Eternal City.
As 0 hours approached, everyone fell silent. Then there was a distant drone. And soon this grew into a rumble and a throb. Fleets of black specks could be seen, trailing long, straight scarves of white vapor. Then these specks turned silver, and the planes were suddenly overhead. Liberators, fortresses, marauders, Mitchells, 1,000 feet up, and then they dipped and opened their bellies. The war correspondent, Christopher Buckley, saw sprout after sprout of black smoke leaping from the earth, coiling upwards like some dark forest of evil fantasy. The ancient brother, Carlo Magno, the last survivor of the Benedictine monks, and a few starving sheep and goats roamed into the vomit-sweet stench of death.
And later on, following another of the bombings, a witness gives his impressions.
Entering Cassino was a vision of the end of the world. It looked as if it had been raked over by some monster comb, and then pounded all over by a giant hammer.
A vision of the end of the world you find little sign of at the Abbey of Monte Cassino today. That's if you avoid the war graves nearby. Hard to forget, this is where thousands died in battle. And that's if you omit tracking down traces recorded in writing or safeguarded in eclectic memorabilia housed in cases. The place has been entirely rebuilt. Sprite, cube-like, modern architecture covers the vast area, with walls that have years for the spiritual legacy of Saint Benedict, walls that help wipe away the tragic past, that stench of death, those sprouts of smoke like some dark forest of evil fantasy. So the spirit of Benedict may live on here in this cradle of Western monasticism, whereas the hopeful words of the Latin motto of the monastery, Succisa Virescit, indicate when you cut something down, it grows back, or rather more poetically, when a tree trunk is severed, it then sprouts forth and flourishes. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.